Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast, interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Monday, the 29th of July. Coming up on the program, why a Libyan security training camp is operating in South Africa. The increasing danger of cybersecurity breaches. Calls are intensifying for Johannesburg's mayor to go. Why we don't have enough PhD students in South Africa. And is the concept of job loyalty a thing of the past? Well, this disclosure came as something of a shocker. On Friday, police said that a suspected military training base had been uncovered in White River in Mpumalanga. Then the new Minister of Police, Senzo Mtunu, said the facility where nearly 100 Libyan nationals were arrested appeared to be more than a military training camp, than a security training academy. I'm in conversation now with Willem Els, Senior Training Coordinator at the Institute for Security Studies. Willem, welcome. And what's your understanding of this entire affair?
Well, if you look at the company that is in question and also their registration at CIRA, it's a security training company, and they are registered to facilitate for various security type training, not only your guard at the gate, but some more sophisticated training, like, for instance, close protection, as well as counter poaching, and farm guards and so on. So and also your CIT, money transit people. So you see, you've got a bit of more sophisticated training that they are registered for, but we must understand that they are accredited to this training, and when they do accredit this training, they have to submit their curriculum. The curriculum and everything must be approved by SACWA as well, and they have to do the training within those lines of approval. And what seems to have happened here is that the police is investigating whether they actually crossed that line.
Where might they have crossed the line then? What would your suspicion be?
Well, if you look at the type of terrain, you know, whenever you look at your special forces, they do very similar obstacle courses and things like that. It depends what shooting. We don't know what type of firearms they use. We don't know what happened on the shooting range, because that will also give you an indication. But it might be that they could have received some specialized military training on maneuvering and shooting. And you see the structures, the towers and everything else, that sort of for grappling and all of that. So it could have happened. Yeah, it could have happened.
How then do you think authorities should proceed with the investigation to ensure that all legal and security aspects, as you've mentioned, are properly addressed?
Well, in the first place, they have to take hands with CIRA. CIRA is your regulatory body, and they are the ones approving this type of training, and they will have to work hand in hand and do inspections and regular inspections on these sites in order to ensure that these people are compliant with their what they have been approved to do. The thing is, you know, what can happen to these people? You know, they can get a warning, they can get a fine, or they can actually close down the facility. So there are various sanctions that can happen. But what is worrying is actually the people that have been trained. We know that Libya is a failed state. It's also a country in conflict. So, you know, there are other dynamics that are coming in there with the type of people that we trained.
If you could flesh that out for me, what would your concern be about Libyans specifically being trained there?
In the first place, if you do foreign military training or you export military equipment, etc., to a country in conflict, you know, we've got the NCACC that has to approve that. So did they get that approval? If not, then there might be sanctioning on that side. But if you look at Libya itself, you know, the governing or the government that is actually recognized internationally, it only occupies about maybe less than 20% of the north western part of Libya, there in Tripoli, as the capital. And then if you look at that, General Haftar with his militia, he controls the vast majority of from Sirte to in the middle of Libya to towards the eastern border, and also almost to the southern border, and all the way to the west under the area that's controlled by the government. So he controls the vast majority of Libya. He's been supported by Egypt and the UAE, and they are... currently, there's sort of a stalemate between them and the recognized government. But in the south, what we have is you've got some tribal militias, but also you have camps from ISIS and Al-Qaeda that operate from there. They make use of this ungoverned spaces, and they operate from there into Mali and Niger and Chad. So, that is the dynamics of Libya.
So also critical to establish at whose behest or under whose authority this training was or is being conducted.
Yeah, I think that will form part of the investigation because that is a militia group, and that makes it a bit more difficult in terms of other legislation. If you look at your NCACC, that has to approve that type of training to a country. And it must be the official, the recognized company that actually apply for that training.
Do you think the presence of such a facility poses any security threat to South Africa or neighboring regions?
Yes and no. It depends how it is being regulated. But we must remember that's not the only facility in South Africa for that. If you look at our security fraternities, it's more or less 2 to 3 times the size of the police service. There's a tremendous need for security. But also more so nowadays in a violent environment for close protection. You know, a lot of tourists, a lot of foreign businessmen coming in, especially with the kidnap for ransom and all the other threats that they face when coming to South Africa. They rent bodyguards to accompany them, and there's a tremendous need for that. And those people are being trained at these facilities. That's why this is not the only facility in South Africa doing that. There are quite a few of them.
Willem Els from the Institute for Security Studies, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So what was your drive to work like today? If you live here in Johannesburg, potholes probably, upended pavement, chances are at least one set of traffic lights were not working and you might not have had a shower due to water shortages. In many ways, say some experts, the city is falling apart or at the very least on the ropes, and calls are growing for the mayor to go. I want to talk now to Julius Kleinhans, Executive Manager for Local Government at Outer, and also member of something called the Joburg Crisis Alliance Steering Committee. Mr. Kleinhans, welcome to you, and I'm wondering what difference it would make if the mayor, Kabelo Gwamanda, and his team were to step down. Surely the squabbling is still going to continue.
Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah, I think politics have become so irresponsible at this day that it has a direct negative effect on our municipalities, and I think it's quite evident throughout the whole country. So, yes, you know, the councillors need to provide this political oversight, but I think there needs to be a clear distinguishing space between, you know, getting their hands dirty and the jobs of officials, you know, and what they are currently doing. I think the executive mayor stance at the moment negatively affects service delivery as it stands.
Where do you think councillors are failing in their oversight? Some would contend that they're doing their very best.
Yeah, you know, I think we do get good councillors and good officials within our municipalities. However, when it comes to politics of the day, and I think this is where a clear line needs to be drawn, you know, there's no ideology in providing basic services. The mandate of a municipality is to do just that and create the infrastructure so that we as citizens and businesses can get on and have economic stimulation. And I think that's where the line needs to be drawn. Currently, we're seeing the coalitions being developed and parties, much as we've seen in Parliament, just taking a stance of the party lines instead of focusing what's best for the city or providing proper services. So we need real, proper, transparent and ethical leaders to start governing our cities.
Where specifically is Mayor Gwamanda and his team failing?
Look, I think firstly they've got an unfunded budget. You know, I think just from a financial point of view, Also with public participation, it's clear that these leaders have taken up positions which they are ill to fill properly, and to give the council, or, well, sorry, the officials within the city clear direction and plans to execute the municipality's mandate to provide sustainable services. And we've seen it again in the budget this year that it's completely underfunded when it comes to maintenance. So we'll see much of the same. And then when it comes to budget allocation, it goes to a lot of, let's say, political gaining kind of perspectives instead of just the basics in making sure that we all have access to sustainable water, electricity, and even roads that we can drive on. So we need someone with proper direction, with a proper plan that communities and business can actually back and get excited about, but also have clarity on when what projects need to be done. And I think the best way to start that is to identify, well, you know, you don't have to identify it. I think all the reports are there, how the city is falling apart. It's really about going on a zero-based budget approach and making sure that you start allocating the funds where they should go.
So how do you do that? How do you go about the process of getting that budget funded?
Yeah, so look, the city is getting funds in and revenue. Like any business, I think it just needs to focus its priorities accordingly. It needs to cut the fat. I think the cost of service has grown so exponentially without any hesitation of the city to cut its fat in that sense. You know, we've seen more salaries and higher salaries being paid out, yet they depend on a lot more additional or external service providers to do the work. We see they're talking about potholes being fixed at 1,200 rand a pothole, and that is not industry standard. You know, you can fix those things at probably half the cost. So it's really about efficiencies, Jeremy. I think if you look at the city power, it's losing about 700 million rand in debt that it cannot recollect over the last 6 months. The city were sitting on a customer debt of 40 billion rand owed to the city by households. You know, there's no clear program or success within debt collection. And what happens is year after year, you see prices and tariffs increase, and it's a very small number of people who are paying. And the equitable share that's being properly allocated that covers the cost. So we are paying for the municipality's insufficiency instead of it actually fixing its own shop.
Julius Clenants, thank you very much indeed. Executive Manager Local Government at the organization Undoing Tax Abuse.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa still isn't close to its National Development Plan target of reaching 100 PhDs per 1 million people by 2030. By 2021, the rate stood at 59 PhDs per million. So is it a funding problem or one of capacity or different priorities? I want to talk now to Zama Mtombeni, who is Chief Researcher in Equitable Education and Economics at the Human Sciences Research Council. A very warm welcome to you. First of all, that goal that I've just mentioned of 100 per 1 million, why is that important?
Well, one of the reasons is that South Africa is trying to, firstly, they've put this goal as a national development plan, as it helps to ensure that in the pipeline, we do have qualified researchers, because currently we do have an issue of the aging professorship. So the more professors that are aging and going out of being academics, you need to have a clear pipeline. Those are one of the reasons why such a goal is important.
And if that pipeline is not sufficiently fed, what is the consequence?
The consequence then, you're having less researchers that have PhDs, because if you remember back then, you were able to be a lecturer with just a master's degree. But now the currency has actually changed, where a lot of researchers and a lot of lecturers need to have PhDs, because the issue is that there's a lack of supervision, because you cannot supervise a PhD student if you yourself do not have a PhD. So those are some of the repercussions that are there if such a goal is not met.
And on a broader canvas, I imagine, the less research we do into important subjects down the line, it has a domino effect on the country's economic growth.
Truly, because research does feed into policy. So when we listen to policymakers being politicians, issues of higher education, issues of economics are not things that they research about, but they feed that evidence from people like ourselves who do the research or find the evidence to support the policy implementation.
So you've mentioned the capacity issue, but surely lack of funding is the most important thing to get a grip on.
Yes, that's one of the issues. Because in South Africa, what we need to understand, a lot of the PhD students are students who are forced to work, and a lot of them are relatively old. And a lot of policies that fund students need you to be at a specific age. The more you are in your mid-30s, the less help you receive financially. Because a lot of these funders want you to be at least 30 and below in order for you to have funding. And my research has shown that a lot of PhD students are mothers. A lot of PhD students are single parents, and a lot of them have to juggle internships and do their PhDs. And the implication of that is that they finish their PhD in a longer time. Some take up to even 7 years and 10 years.
So let me ask you two questions, and they're both interlinked. One is, what changes are needed in financial assistance programs? And two, how can universities, to your point, introduce more flexibility?
I believe that one of the changes, the policy change around funding, because one of the biggest funders for PhDs is the National Research Fund. So in South Africa, we have a cap that we believe that people who are young are 18 to 35, which means that we're expecting that at the age of 35, people should be thriving in their careers and they should not be financially dependent. But stats are telling us something different, that a lot of people are actually doing their first degrees at that time. A lot of people need financial assistance. So I believe that the first thing that needs to be done is to broaden the age gap, for especially at PhD level, because it's quite a technical and a specialized degree where you're not expecting an 18-year-old to be doing a PhD. But a lot of people are quite into their career by the time they do their PhD, meaning that they are quite long, and some do it as an entry to their career. So they may be needing a lot of assistance. And in terms of universities, the flexibility should be that. One of the issues that I cited in my research is that if you are registered as a part-time student, which a lot of the PhD students are, there's financial assistance that you do not receive. One of my participants in my study even said that there's fee remission in their institution, but you only get that fee remission if you are registered as a full-time student. So now the implication here is that people are penalized for doing their studies part-time. So there needs to be that sense of flexibility and to understand who are the people doing PhDs. These are not students who are coming just from fourth year into PhD. Some take gaps in between to go work, even in non-related academic careers. So we need to be a bit flexible in terms of how we support and fund PhD students.
Also a crucial role, I imagine, for research organizations such as yours, as well as employers.
Exactly, as to come to the party. Also, not just financially, because some of them, they do lose motivation along the way. Some of them, it's emotional distress that they face along the way. So we do need mentors. We do need specialists to actually guide the students. And organizations like myself do play a crucial role in doing so.
Do you think we're going to get this right, or are you despondent?
I believe that with the right policy implementations, and I do believe that with the right collaborations, it is possible to get it right, because once we have collaborations between research councils and the universities in terms of knowledge sharing, because some of the participants do indicate that they do get a lot of support from working as in research councils, also in universities, and getting that sort of supervision and getting that sort of skill transfer, it does assist a lot. I do believe that if we intensify the type of collaboration, we will get it right.
Zama Ntombeni, thank you very much indeed from the Human Sciences Research Council. I do appreciate your input today. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, we have in recent weeks seen an uptick in cyber breaches, most notably in the public service. and it is a huge cause for concern, says Omotayo Ogunlade, who is Chief Technology Officer at Onafrique, which is a Pan-African payments company which enables interoperable cross-border and domestic digital payments. He joins me on the program now. And what then, in your opinion, is driving this increase?
Absolutely, you would have also seen that there is an upshift in trends of technology, particularly the appreciation of AI and the possibility that comes around artificial intelligence. And definitely with increase in the possibility as it pertains to ease of doing things with technology, definitely we would have an increase in the threats and vulnerability and potential breaches that these things would bring about. So essentially, technology is evolving, so also as a threat.
We also know that digital payments on the continent have become a lot more complex. Where do you think then the most significant cybersecurity vulnerabilities are?
To be honest, right, it cuts across several places, and mobile money is one of them, alongside Internet of Things. But you find out that with mobile money, because there's just so many complications around it, around the world, people can swap SIMs, people can more or less hijack SIM cards, and so on and so forth. It poses a lot of threats, especially as the way it is managed. Unlike what you have with bank accounts, which is just banks, and you'll find that these banks also have strict rules as it pertains to owning of accounts, KYC, and so on and so forth. So it cuts across different sectors differently, but I think mobile money, Internet of Things, and so on and so forth are greatly affected.
And do you think the interconnected nature of Africa's financial systems are leading to greater risk in the specific space?
Absolutely, absolutely. It leads to greater risk because we all have different levels of maturity as it pertains to cybersecurity framework. And you'll find countries like South Africa, Kenya, and Nigeria, where they've made significant strides in establishing comprehensive cybersecurity laws and regulations. However, others are still in their very early stages and early stages of developing their frameworks. Of course, you also find that enforcement of regulation can be inconsistent with several other countries. So again, as you connect one node to another, the weakest one then becomes your major risk or your major issue at the end of the day.
So where do you think more work needs to be done in terms of increasing or improving the regulatory frameworks?
To be honest, it still boils down to government and also collaboration. So governments of nations needs to collaborate and also enforce these cybersecurity frameworks across board, such that we all speak the same language, as in common language, as it pertains to cybersecurity, and also ensure that all those connected to this network, irrespective of who they are and how they play within the industry, all still are guided by this central framework. Of course, as you would know, there are efforts to harmonize cybersecurity regulations through regional bodies, such as African Union, but there's also still much more to be done.
What do you think is preventing that further collaboration or more effective collaboration?
I mean, just like every other thing in Africa, right? We are so close to each other, but very far from each other, right? So every government have their own political interest, have their own focus, have things that they take as priority. So while some other governments are really moving as it pertains to technology, cybersecurity, and how they develop their economy, others are still scratching the surface, trying to sell raw materials, focused on things that probably several people have left behind several years ago. So it's still a mix of our current state of leadership across Africa and the level at which people take or leaders take seriously issues that pertain to cybersecurity.
Are there certain countries, do you think, that are more at risk than others? What is on your risk radar screen?
Okay, so I mentioned earlier that several other countries like South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, and the likes of Rwanda, right, are all coming up nicely and staying very strong. And we have, of course, I mean, over 40 more, right, that are still scratching the surface in Africa, And you'll see that many of them are even still faced with other particular political issues, war-torn areas. This will be less of their concerns as this time.
As a CTO, what is your biggest concern on a day-to-day basis?
In the context of cybersecurity, is to ensure that we are abreast of all the things that going on, but to also make sure that every single time we design a product to be launched, we are thinking security first and infusing security in the way users interact day to day with the solutions that we provide. Again, at Honor Freak, we provide rails that allows interconnectedness across nations, bridging the gap and making borders matter less, right? And in doing this, right, there's so much about security. But for us, in designing the products and these use cases, we have infused, or we every single time infuse security into it, in the way we host, in terms of our infrastructure, in the way the products are being used as it pertains to educating the users every single time transactions are about to happen or happening. And of course, I mean, leveraging on artificial intelligence for fraud detection and so on and so forth.
Just finally, do you think the weak link is always going to be in the public sector?
To be honest, the answer is yes. And the reason is not far-fetched. You find that the private sector are very, very concerned about this because it can either break or make them. And everyone and shareholders and stakeholders will lose all of their investment. In the public sector, because the consequences are still there, but people can always shy away from who takes responsibility. You always find there the weaknesses exist in that area.
I am going to leave it there with my thanks. Omotayo Ogunlade, thank you very much indeed, Chief Technology Officer at OnAfric. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program, younger South Africans are known these days as real job hoppers. So is this a good thing? Why is it happening and what's the impact, both good and bad? Dion Chang is the founder and chief executive officer of Flux Trends. Dion, a warm welcome to you. So what are the reasons here?
Hi, Jeremy. Yes, I'm actually not surprised by the stats and that they came out. I think there's a disconnect of saying why do they job hop rather than why can companies not retain or engage those younger workers? So if you look at the stats, obviously the younger workers that are job hopping, I think that's quite normal if it's sort of between the 18 to 24 years age. But then as you grow older, when you're starting to get into your career development, that one is very high. And for me, kind of unsurprising if I look at the disconnect between management styles and this new generation, and we're talking Gen Zs here coming through into the workforce, and their approach to careers and how they define a career and what they want out of a career compared to the managers who are much older and their kind of trajectory of what a career is.
And interestingly, Dion Chang, it's not just about money, is it?
No, not at all. And I think what we miss is the fact that for this generation, a career and a job is firstly a learning journey. So you want to learn as much as possible. And therein lies the first disconnect is because if you look at kind of an older management style, it's you are a junior, you must sit down and you don't know the business. Whereas this generation has a lot of agency in terms of their experience on social media, social justice issues, all of those kind of things. So they want to participate, but they're not allowed to participate. The other thing is also they don't view a career trajectory as a very linear one, but much more of a career portfolio. So you kind of look at different things and you pick up different skills as you go along. So if they're not picking up a certain skill or they're not learning and they are not given any kind of agency or there's no speak up culture within their organization, then why would they want to stay there? So I think that's one of the big fundamentals that's really, really kind of a disconnect between how people manage or what management feels is not a loyalty quotient. Let's put it that way.
So what does management need to do in terms of changing its mindset or headspace, given that it does have responsibility to stakeholders, it's often skating on a thin margin, and it's responsible for profit?
I think what management needs to do is re-look kind of what's happened post-pandemic. And I think that goes not only for a younger workforce, but the workforces in general. there's a huge fundamental shift in what people really want out of work. That work-life balance is kind of almost a non-negotiable now, the flexibility, all of those kind of things. And I think we've got a management style that's sort of stuck in a 20th century corporate mold and has not really evolved into that. So instead of your very traditional management attributes, as you know, you kind of crack the whip and you want to be assertive, you've got to do that. There's a very different way of managing a workforce. It's nurturing, it's kind of learning people and making sure that people kind of grow. So they say that there's a huge confluence, or we're at a crossroads in terms of work and the future of work and careers, a convergence of technology and purpose. And I think if you don't give people that sense of purpose or the sense that they have achieved something, then people are going to say, why do I stay here? I should just, might as well just leave. Mm. And then just quickly, Jeremy, the other thing, the very interesting thing is we did a research project called the 30-30-30 Project just before the elections. So 30 conversations with under 30s, 30 years into democracy. And the one spillover, I mentioned the kind of spillover from about agency with social media, came out quite strongly there. And that was of a fractured identity. So if you look at kind of a young person, there's always a side hustle and how they show up on different social media platforms. So, you know, TikTok is for my side hustle. Instagram is for FOMO. Facebook is where the elders are, so I'm on my best behavior. But within that, you start understanding that when I come to work, or this generation, when I come to a company, I'm not going to give you 100% of everything that I do, which is what an older generation used to do. So, which is why they draw quite firm lines, which is very disconcerting for a management kind of style to say, I will give you this much, but no further. I'm not going to give you 100% of myself 100% of the time. And I think that is what's causing the biggest conflict in the workplace at the moment.
But interestingly, Dion, against that backdrop, it's difficult then to create that sense of purpose that you talk about, or is it?
I would disagree. I think it is a management style that needs to be adjusted, and it is about learning, because I've spoken to a lot of people, especially young people, that say, I learn a lot. I've been given room to grow. I did a workshop the other day where, you know, the suggestion was, instead of just being in a very siloed company, and my career is just in the silo, why don't they, and some companies are doing, not a lot of them, are allowing people to go cross-department to start learning about the entire business, the whole ecosystem with that. And I don't think a lot of companies do that. Like I said, I think it's a very 20th century kind of perspective of saying, this is your role, you're a junior, sit down, shut up, and we'll keep you in the silo, and we're not going to listen to what you say. But you're seeing much more forward-thinking companies actually have Gen Z shadow boards that say, tell us what we're doing wrong. So, for example, one of the big global sportswear brands, they have a Gen Z shadow board that holds the management to account for all of their sustainability promises and pledges that they've done, which I thought was a very clever way of looking at it.
Always good talking to you. Dion Chang, thank you very much indeed, the founder and chief executive officer of Flux Trends. And Dion, very quickly, before I let you go, you have a new book out, don't you?
Yes, it's called No Surprises, The Future. It's a team effort with Faiza Khan and Bronwyn Williams, all at Flux. And essentially, it's over 80 trends for business that kind of look ahead and what you should be looking at. And I think most importantly, the blind spots and unintended consequences of where your business might be going.
Thank you very much indeed. And leading on from that conversation, that informs our poll today, South Africa's changing job culture. And are you finding it frustrating? Do you think that company loyalty is gone, or is all of this part of a bigger global trend? If you have a view on that, I'll invite you to go to either our X or LinkedIn page. On our Friday poll, we spoke about the soaring cost of orange juice in South Africa. It's now a luxury, I asked. I need my morning orange juice. 45%, though, of our respondents saying they've now switched to water. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're up as a podcast straight after that. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.